All right, welcome everybody to Bio 241. And it is March 27th. And don't forget, SI has changed rooms. The new room is SEM 106. It's no longer going to be in BUS. It's at SEM 106. All right, so if you forget the room number, you can always check the recording. So March 27th, we're going to finish up with senses, move on to endocrine system. And let's see, where are we on the schedule? We're a week right before spring break. And, we're a little bit behind, so I'll have to talk faster to catch up. All right, so we definitely want to get through endocrinology because that's on the exam after spring break. So that first week right after spring break, there is exam number 3, but it's not on a Tuesday, right? It's on Thursday. So we got a couple of lectures to pick up on. All right, so we were talking about special senses. Who can remember what a special sense is as opposed to a general sense? Yeah, it relies on special kinds of receptors that you have just in one or two locations in your body. And you can really conceive of it as just one location. All right, and so what were some of those special senses? What about proprioception? Is that a special sense? Proprioception? What the heck is proprioception? Oh, I'm sure I talked about it. Well, maybe I talked about it in anatomy, but not here. What's proprioception? Okay, because we're going to talk about muscles. Proprioception is sensors in muscles that can measure the tension in muscles. There are receptors in joints that can measure pressure and tension in joints and angulation of joints. So it gives the cerebellum feedback as to what the musculoskeletal system is doing. All right, and so they're in all muscles. So can that be a special sense? It can be in all joints. So that is not a special sense, even though it sounds like it's special, proprioception. But it's not, because it's where? Found everywhere in your body. All right, so what are the special senses? How many are there? There's 5. Let's see if we can figure out what they are. Sight, yeah, okay, so vision. Sight, vision, that's good. Hearing? Smell? Okay, what do we call smell? Olfaction? Gustation? And equilibrium. Ah, but there's 2 kinds of equilibrium that we talked about. There's static and kinetic. Static is just the force of gravity. It's linear acceleration, so static is linear acceleration. But you can also sense spinning, acceleration and spinning, or deceleration of spinning. That's what we call kinetic equilibrium. Different parts of the ear. All right, so that's what we have right here. Now we're to the ear. We talked about the vestibular apparatus last time, namely the vestibule and semicircular canals. Semicircular canals are for angular acceleration. The vestibule right here is for linear acceleration. And that leaves one last sense, and that is for hearing. And hearing involves the cochlea. It kind of looks like a snail right here. It's something that's all wrapped up. It just wound up on itself. That is the cochlea. All right, but don't forget about the 3 major parts of the ear, which is the external ear from the pinna of the ear, or sometimes we call that the auricle. It includes the external auditory meatus, and it stops right here at the tympanic membrane. And the kind of sense that we're measuring right now, I think we talked about it last time, was sound. And sound is a wave, and waves have a wavelength, they have amplitude. And sound is a physical wave. It's a physical pressure wave that is propagated through some kind of medium. For instance, like air or water, or sound can even travel through a tabletop, for instance, because it's just it's a pressure wave. It's not electromagnetic, which is another kind of wave that we're going to look at in the next section. So a pressure wave, right, pushes this tympanic membrane back and forth, produces a vibration in the tympanic membrane. That's the entrance to the middle ear. And then the vibrations are transmitted by the auditory ossicles. Probably you can remember what they are from anatomy. These auditory ossicles are included in the middle ear. And the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane should be equal so that the membrane can vibrate very nice and freely. And this inner chamber, or this middle chamber of the ear, is at atmospheric pressure because here's a little tube that connects to your pharynx. What the heck is your pharynx? What's a common name for pharynx? That is your throat. Pharynx is throat. Larynx is your windpipe. All right, so that's your throat. So that connects up to your throat. And that equalizes pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane so that normally it can vibrate nice and freely back and forth, vibrating the auditory ossicles. Right, unless you have a middle ear infection, then it's filled with all kinds of garbage and the tympanic membrane doesn't vibrate. And then what do things kind of sound like when you have that condition? You can't hear very well, right, because the tympanic membrane isn't vibrating. All right, the last auditory ossicle, or the distal from the tympanic membrane right here, is the stapes, and it actually looks like a stirrup you'd use for riding a horse. It's connected up to the beginning of the inner ear. And there's a window, there's a membrane underneath the stapes. And does anybody remember what the name of that window is? Yeah, because look at the area, or look at the shape of the stapes, and is it what, square, or circular, or oval, or what? It's oval, right? So if you look at just the structure right here, so that's got to be an oval window. So the stapes moves back and forth and pressurizes fluid, inside the labyrinth of the inner ear right here. So sound wave then is transmitted from the environment into this structure right here, and it's going to end up in the cochlea. All right, so the oval window is the entrance to the cochlea. So you have that energy inside the cochlea, and we're going to look and see how that is transduced into your perception of hearing. All right, so we want to look at the cochlea. All right, so don't forget these three parts of the ear. And here is the cochlea. So what has happened to the cochlea on this illustration right here? It has been unrolled. That was the word I was searching for. Okay, it has been unrolled. If you look at the cochlea, it's all rolled up. And why do you think it's rolled up inside your head? And as a matter of fact, let's talk just a little bit about where it is inside your head, because you're familiar with it. Maybe you just can't remember. All right, so where is the vestibule and the cochlea located? It's located inside a bone. Which bone is that? It's that temporal bone, right? Because it's kind of exactly where your ear is, right? And the external acoustic meatus is right inside the temporal bone. And then what part of the temporal bone has the cochlea embedded in it? It's called the petrous region, right? The region right between the internal and external acoustic meatus is the petrous region. And that's where we have the bony labyrinth for equilibrium, the two senses of equilibrium and the one sense of hearing. So here's that cochlea unwound. And why is it rolled up inside that petrous region normally? Yeah, basically just so that it can fit. It's a very long structure, and there's no reason why this cochlea should be sticking outside of our heads. Right, so a nice evolutionary process has figured out a way to roll it up so it fits in a nice compact little package that fits inside the petrous region of the temporal bone. But if you unroll it, okay, and look at it, so let's take a look at this cochlea that has been unrolled. So here is the stapes with the oval window, which is vibrating back and forth and producing sound waves, right, into this first little membrane compartment. Right, which is what we call the scala vestibuli, and it's filled with perilymph, which is a fluid. Right, so the sound wave enters through this compartment right here, and then it's going to move across an inner compartment right here, which is what we call the cochlear duct, and it has fluid in it as well, but we call this endolymph, and then that sound wave can actually flow right through the cochlear duct into the scala tympani right here, into some more perilymph. So this is all perilymph surrounding the cochlear duct. And then that pressure is released because there's another window in the cochlea that we call the round window. So that energy enters the oval and it leaves the round window. It doesn't get trapped inside the ear, because if it did, then it would actually damage the cells and the tissues of the inner ear. So the energy comes in and then it's allowed to release itself at the round window. All right, well, this reminds me of something that we use for sound all the time, okay? And I can see these little divisions right here. Does this remind you of any kind of musical instrument that has all of these little divisions in it that you can use to produce sound? For instance, that looks like a piano to me. And as a matter of fact, it really is a piano. Okay, And you have a piano inside the cochlea on each side of your head, right, which then sends action potentials to parts of the temporal lobe, and you actually have something that is resembling a piano inside the temporal lobe. So that if you stimulate one area of the temporal lobe, you'll hear a high note. If you stimulate the other end, you'll hear a low note. And if you stimulate some place in between, then you'll hear like a mid-tone note. All right, now how does a piano work? If you ever looked inside a piano, are all the strings the same length? No, they're all different length. And what about the diameter? Is the diameter of all the strings the same? As a matter of fact, it's not, right? This is just the nature of our universe. If there is something that's very thin and small, it has a tendency to vibrate at a high frequency, right? Which means what? High frequency is a high frequency, okay? And if it's very big and a large diameter, it's going to vibrate at a low frequency just by its natural tendencies, right? So the cochlea, right, is built upon that same kind of principle. So we see that this end of the cochlea, which is the inner part right here, is going to vibrate at a low frequency, and the part over here that's closest to the oval and round window will vibrate at a high frequency. And the reason why that is, because if we go back and look at the cochlea, it's hard to appreciate on this diagram, but here is the part that's going to vibrate at a low frequency, because if you were to pinch it from side to side, which we can't see here, if you're going to pinch it from side to side, that's the thick part of the cochlea. And then as you move around, it gets thinner and thinner and thinner until you get to this area right here, and this is the thinnest part of the cochlea. All right, so when low frequencies come in, right, when they vibrate into the cochlea, this is the part that will resonate with it. High frequencies will resonate with this part of the cochlea. And there are different nerves attached to the cochlea. And we can see what the frequency distribution is. So high frequencies, right, will come in to the perilymph and then cross through the cochlear duct into the perilymph within the scala tympani right here, stimulating these cells, and then these cells eventually will send action potentials to that high frequency part of the brain, and then you'll hear a high frequency sound. Right, and low frequencies go all the way close to the helicotrema, which is the end of the cochlea, which is this region right here. That's the thick part, but unfortunately we can't really see that in the diagram. Right, sound will go across and stimulate these cells over here. All right, and then guess what's the name of the nerve that takes that information to the brain? Yeah, it's the vestibulocochlear nerve, right, that takes it to the brain, those action potentials. So you don't really hear frequencies in the brain. What does your brain actually hear? Yeah, which is what? A dit, 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 dit. So if the brain is hearing dit, 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 dits from this part of the cochlea, you're going to interpret that as a low frequency, but if you hear dit, 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 dit in the part of the brain that's connected to this part of the cochlea, you're going to hear a high frequency. So remember, the language of the brain is or are action potentials only. All right, so you got perilymph in the scala vestibuli, which is connected to the oval window. Perilymph is continuous in the scala tympani that's connected to the round window. And in between, you've got endolymph, another compartment. So the cochlea is what we call the bony labyrinth for hearing. The membranous labyrinth right here contains the organ for transducing sound energy into action potentials. Right, and action potentials will be produced in different regions of that membranous labyrinth based on its size, just like a piano. All right, so if we have a cross-section of that same structure we were looking at, the cochlea, I can see the bony labyrinth right here. Here's the scala vestibuli connected to the oval window. Here's the scala tympani connected to the round window. And then here's the cochlear duct that has endolymph in it. There are some additional structures. There's a tectorial membrane, kind of like a flap, that pokes out into the cochlear duct. So let's zoom into this region right here. Let's zoom way in. And if we look, here's that tectorial membrane. And the tectorial membrane will vibrate when that characteristic frequency passes through the cochlear duct, depending on where that location is. And attached to this tectorial membrane are some cells that have stereocilia on them. And they're attached to the tectorial membrane so that when it vibrates, guess what happens to these cells right here? Because they have stereocilia. It can open or close various ion channels. It will stimulate the cell, and we call this a hair cell as well. All right, and it's going to release neurotransmitter on the vestibulocochlear nerve, right, which is a generator potential, which then can trigger action potentials, which will go to the brain. All right, so this is pretty fascinating because we looked at the crista ampullaris and the maculae, and it used the same kinds of cells. What were the cells that were responsible for transducing angular acceleration into action potentials in the semicircular canals? Hair cells. Are you kidding me? You're not kidding me. And you're right, they are hair cells, okay? Which is a really strange thing, right? So evolution has figured out a way, or through the process of evolution, has figured out a way to use the same kind of cell, a hair cell, for vastly different kinds of senses in your body. Right, one for hearing, one for static equilibrium, and one for kinetic equilibrium. Okay, because the stereocilia can change permeability of this membrane of the hair cell to various ions. It can be excitatory if it opens up a sodium channel, or it can be inhibitory, for instance, if it closes sodium channels or opens up potassium channels, or maybe opens up a chloride channel. Okay, so here is the vestibulocochlear nerve bringing signals into the medulla, okay, and they cross over, most cross over to the other side of the medulla, and then up into the midbrain, and remember, there's a couple nuclei that you can see externally placed, superficially placed in the midbrain, part of the corpora quadrigemina that is involved with localizing sound. Can you remember anything about that corpora quadrigemina, maybe in the midbrain? Well, there's the inferior and superior colliculus. Here's the inferior colliculus, right? It's the lower of the two bumps. And this is the region right here where it can compare the signals in time from the right side of your head to the left side. So if you hear sound on the right side of your body first compared to the left side, you know where sound is coming from, right? It's coming from your right side. So we could do an experiment. If I was really fast, you could close your eyes, and I could open up this door, or that door, or that door, or that door, and you could tell me exactly where the sound was coming from, right? Due to this inferior colliculus right here. All right, and then just a little bit some more neural anatomy than these signals. There's another neuron that takes these signals to the relay station, right, in the diencephalon before it goes to the temporal lobe. So this is the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. And what is that relay station in the diencephalon, where almost all sensory signals have to synapse before they go to the cerebral cortex? And that is the thalamus, indeed. Okay, and the thalamus then tells these signals where to go. And then in the temporal lobe, you have something that's very similar to a piano again, right? So the more medial parts will accept action potentials that come from the low frequency part of the brain, and then, the cochlea. And then the more lateral regions right here will be receiving action potentials from the high frequency part of the cochlea. And depending on what region is stimulated, you will hear different notes. And what happens if three different areas are stimulated at the same time? Okay, you will hear, that's basically the definition of a chord. Okay, so chords are composed of those individual frequencies that we hear. All right, so this organ right here is what we call the organ of Corti. It's responsible for hearing. So the organ, what was the organ for angular acceleration? That was the crista ampullaris. What was the organ for linear acceleration in the vestibule? That was the maculae, all right, that are contained in the utricle and saccule. All right, so it might be pretty important. Let's see what I can do right here. You have this in Blackboard, but here is a nice little cheat sheet or synopsis, all right, of the ear. And remember, there are three senses in the ear. All right, so what are these three senses? Hearing, for sure, is one. And don't forget, these are special senses. You have static equilibrium, which senses linear acceleration. And you have kinetic equilibrium, which senses angular acceleration. What's another more common word for angular acceleration? Spinning or twisting, something like that, right? Just not a linear directional change. All right, what are the three parts of the ear? Yeah, outer, middle, and inner. All right, so what, as far as the external ear is concerned, and these three different senses right here, do any of these senses require the external ear to work properly? What about for equilibrium? No, right, because that's only the inner ear. What about kinetic equilibrium? Only the inner ear. Hearing, it helps, right, because it helps funnel sound energy into the external acoustic meatus, so we say yes, no, and no. What about the middle ear? Is that important for either equilibrium sense? It's not. All right. What is inside the middle ear? You have the tympanic membrane and the auditory ossicles, for instance. And what are they doing? They're transmitting vibrations, sound vibrations. So for sure they're important for hearing. Right? The middle ear is important for hearing. All right. And then the inner ear. What is that used for? All three. Right? So that's where all three of these senses, all these transductions takes place in the inner ear. All right, the bony labyrinth you should know as well for these three senses. We said is the cochlea for hearing, the vestibule for static equilibrium, and the semicircular canals for spinning. Hopefully that will hang in there a little bit. So let's talk faster before that projector dies completely. Yeah, I can maybe switch it. Okay, I'll switch it. At least that's the plan, to switch it. Did it switch? It switched. Okay, inside the bony labyrinth, there's a membranous labyrinth. So you should know the name of the membranous labyrinth. It's a cochlear duct for hearing. It's the utricle and saccule for static equilibrium. And it's the semicircular ducts within the semicircular canals, right? So you got bony labyrinth, membranous labyrinth. Now, what about the receptor organ? For hearing, we just said it was the organ of Corti. Okay, and can you remember kind of the architecture? You had hair cells poking up and the stereo cilia poking up into that tectorial membrane. And for static equilibrium, it's the maculae. And it's the crista ampullaris for kinetic equilibrium. All right, and then the last column we have right here is the receptor cell. And it's probably pretty fascinating to realize that it's what? Exactly the same receptor cell for each of those different senses. All right, now why do you perceive these three different senses differently if they have the same receptor cell? How is that possible? Because it all depends on where those action potentials go. So these hair cells produce action potentials and they go to different parts of the brain. And the different parts of the brain will give you the different perception of what's happening to you, right? So, for instance, where do the action potentials from hair cells in the organ of Corti, where do they have to go? That was the temporal lobe. We call that the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe, right about here. Okay. But if we were to take those same action potentials from these hair cells and then reroute them to the occipital lobe, which is used for vision, what would your experience be when sound waves stimulated the organ of Corti? So if sound waves stimulated the organ of Corti that produced action potentials, but somehow those action potentials went to the occipital lobe, what would be your perception? You would have the perception of vision. You would see something. Who knows what it would be like? Okay? Probably just flashes or something. Who knows? Okay, so it's the part of the brain that gives you perception, not the action potentials, okay, or the receptor organs, or the receptor cells, right? The receptor organs and cells just are there to transduce some form of energy into what language? Action potentials, right? Okay. Yeah, it's in Blackboard, it's in documents, probably way down on the bottom, so you can do that. Yeah, if you can't write it out yourself, go ahead and print it out, take a look at it. Because it's probably pretty handy to answer some questions that are at the end of the book or in the study guide. Okay, so let's get back to vision. Projector seems to be working now, so what I'm going to do is, I think this. One and one. Vision. All right, so vision has to do with receptor cells, and receptor cells transduce waves into action potentials, but totally different kinds of waves. The waves that we use for vision, okay, I have to find my, here it is. Hey, The waves that are used for vision are electromagnetic waves. They're not pressure waves. So they're not physical waves of high and low pressure variations that are traveling through some kind of medium, but they're electromagnetic, and we don't need to get into electromagnetic wave theory very much, but here is the whole spectrum of electromagnetic energy coming from the sun. Okay, so we have very long waves over here on the right-hand side. These are radio waves. And then we have microwaves, which are a little bit bigger than infrared, ultraviolet, and in between infrared and ultraviolet is the visible light spectrum. And then as the waves get shorter and shorter and shorter, that gets into X-rays and gamma rays. So all of these wavelengths come from the sun, and we can't see many of these, which are the only ones that we can see, right here in the visible light spectrum. What's another name for the visible light spectrum? White light, okay. But you can actually see the visible light spectrum. For instance, maybe even over the weekend you saw it. And a rainbow, right? So visible light spectrum and rainbow are kind of like synonymous terms. And you can see the colors of the rainbow right here. At least most of you can. And then here are the particular wavelengths. So as the wavelength changes, the color of light that we perceive changes. And does anybody know how to describe this rainbow right here in terms of these different colors? Okay, I usually think of somebody's name like Roy G. Biv. Okay, so red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. These are different colors. They have different wavelengths. They even have different energies associated with them. So light is energy, and that energy can be used to produce action potentials in a special sense organ named the eye, right? Because the eye can absorb these different energies, right, based on the different wavelengths right here. All right, so you have some accessory structures besides the photoreceptors inside the eye. And, of course, you have eyebrows and eyelids and eyelashes that help protect the eye. And then there's something that moistens the eye. What do we call that gland that moistens the eye so it doesn't turn into a potato chip and get all cracked? That would be the lacrimal gland. If somebody said tarsal glands, those are similar kinds of glands, but they're in the palpebrae, right? They're not inside the orbit. Okay, and then here's another accessory structure that regulates the amount of light that enters the eye, and it is the iris. That's the colored part of the eye. We also see the white part of the eye right here. That's the sclera. That's a really tough layer that gives the eyeball its particular shape, but it also protects the eye. All right, so here is the iris, and the black part of the iris that we see right here is what we call the pupil. But the pupil is not really a structure. It's a foramen. What's the function of a foramen? It's a passageway for something. So what's passing through the pupil right here? Light, right? So it's not really part of the iris, it's just a hole in the iris. Okay, and it can change shape. There are two different kinds of muscles that make up the iris. There are circular smooth muscles and there are radial smooth muscles. And they're controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So when the sympathetic stimulation reaches the iris right here, then the radial fibers contract, all right, and so that's going to pull on these circular fibers and that's going to dilate the pupil. So what's going to happen to the amount of light entering the eye when the sympathetic nervous system is stimulated? It's going to increase because the pupil gets bigger, and that's what's going to happen in what? Dim light, to let more light enter the eye for vision. In normal light, okay, both the radial and circular muscles are contracted to about the same degree, and you have an intermediate sized pupil. But then in bright light, the parasympathetic nervous system is going to stimulate contraction of the circular muscles right here, and it's going to cause constriction of the iris and constriction of the pupil, and thereby allowing less light to enter the eye. So we see very dim light, normal light, and very bright light. But because the iris is adjusting to the light conditions, the amount of light that is reaching the retina is pretty much the same regardless of how bright it is outside. That's kind of nice how that works, right? So in this sense, we can see that this parasympathetic and sympathetic work against each other to what produce really the same amount of light reaching the retina irrespective of how much light is surrounding us. All right, so that is the iris. There's another muscle inside the eye, and that's the ciliary muscle. I see the ciliary muscle. It's another circular muscle, and it has some, well, they're called ligaments. That's kind of a misnomer, because what is a ligament typically in anatomy? That's a bone-to-bone connection, right? I don't see any bones here anywhere. I see a muscle-to-lens connection. I probably would have liked to have called that a tendon, right? But everybody calls it suspensory ligament. So these ligaments right here attach to the lens, and it can put tension on the lens or release tension, and it's going to change the shape of the lens depending on the state of relaxation or contraction of this ciliary muscle. And it allows us to focus on something that's either close to us at one time or farther away. And that process of changing where you're focusing your attention or your vision is what we call accommodation. All right, so we could do a quick experiment really fast in class. You could take your fingernail on your index finger and put it way out in front of you like this. Extend your arm all the way out. Okay, and then concentrate on your fingernail. So that's it, so that it is in focus. Is it in focus? Yeah, good. And now what about the background? Is it in focus? No. You can only focus at one distance at a time. So you can focus on your fingernail. Everything behind it is out of focus. Now focus right behind, at a distance behind your fingernail. Right? So I see stuff in the distance. Now what about your fingernail? Is it in focus? Absolutely not. I see like two or three or four right there. Alright, so you can focus at one particular distance, but not from close up to far away at the same time. That process of changing your distance of focus is what we call accommodation. And in order for you to accommodate, this muscle has to contract and the shape of the lens has to change. And that just can't happen instantaneously, so it takes a little while for that shape to change. Okay, so here we see a couple eyeballs. The top condition right here, the lens is relatively thin, and then the bottom diagram, the lens is relatively thick, and that's because different amounts of tension are being applied by the suspensory ligaments. So this system is a little bit different compared to what you're used to. When you have a tendon that's attached to a muscle, when do you find tension applied to that tendon? When the muscle contracts or when it relaxes? So here I have a tendon from the biceps going up to like a coracoid process. When does that coracoid process experience tension? When the biceps contracts or when the biceps relaxes? When it contracts, right? This particular example is going to be the opposite, right? The tension in these suspensory ligaments is reduced when the muscle contracts because it's a circular muscle. When the muscle contracts, the circle gets smaller and then it produces a relaxed tension in the suspensory ligaments. But when the ciliary muscle relaxes, it gets to be a bigger diameter, and that's when tension is applied to the suspensory ligaments. So it kind of operates in a different way that people usually think of how a tendon works. Okay, and when the ciliary muscle is relaxed, it expands to a big circle, puts tension on the suspensory ligaments, and that pulls on the lens, and when it pulls on the lens, it flattens the shape of the lens out, right? And when the lens gets flat, that means that it is acting less like a lens and more just like a window, and it doesn't bend light very much. It just so happens when an object is close to you, the light rays are entering your eye at a very large angle. Right, so when things are close to you, entering your eye at a very large angle, you need a lens that has more curvature to bend the light back so that it focuses on your retina. Light that's really far away from you doesn't reach your face at a large angle, because what about all those light rays leaving the object at a large angle? They don't even hit your eye. They're like way over your head, way below your feet. They don't enter your eye. Light entering your eye from objects that are far away is very parallel. And that kind of light doesn't need to be bent very much to focus on your retina. So objects that are far away need a very thin lens. The light does not have to be bent to be focused on the retina, right? But light that's coming from very close to you needs a thick lens with a lot of curvature to bend the light back so it focuses on the retina. And that's what the job of the ciliary body is, to change the shape of the lens. Okay, you also see something else on this diagram, and that is there's something else that can bend light. It has a lot of curvature besides the lens that light has to pass through. Okay, so remember the three layers of the eye? You've got the sclera right here in the choroid, and then here is the retina from anatomy, and then continuous division of the sclera. When we get to the anterior part of the eye, what is this right here? That's the cornea. And look at the shape of the cornea. Is it flat or is it curved? It's curved. And as a matter of fact, the cornea does more to focus light on the retina than the lens does. So the cornea really is the primary structure that focuses light, but you can't change the shape of your cornea, so it's not good for accommodation. It just has a fixed focusing power, and that's it. All right, so you need this additional lens to compensate for how far away an object is from your eye. Okay. Some people use the cornea or can adjust the cornea to improve your vision. And that is what the LASIK procedure, when somebody takes a laser and changes the shape of the cornea, matches the shape of the cornea to the distance to the retina, and then that can give people very excellent vision for that period of time until your eyeball changes shape again. All right, so that is accommodation. All right, a visual acuity, right, depends on the shape of your eyeball, and acuity is just the resolving power of your eye. So does something look sharply focused or is it out of focus? If something is out of focus and you might have two objects, it will look like one blurry object instead of two individual ones. But if things are sharply focused and two closely spaced objects, you can actually separate and see that they're two separate objects. We call that resolving power. All right, so there are some abnormal conditions. Well, let's look at a normal condition first. The normal condition is when light is coming into the eye, and you can see this light, these light rays right here are kind of separated from each other. If they reach the retina like this, it will produce blurry vision. So the cornea and the lens will work together to bend these light rays back to a single point because they're coming from a single object, a single point in space, and then it will look like a nice sharp object. If they focus right on the retina, on the posterior pole of the eye, the object will look really nice and sharp. Right, so this is what we're going to define this as normal vision, and we call that emmetropia. The light rays are focused right on the retina. And if that's the case, then no corrective lens before the eye is needed because all the light rays are focusing right on this point where they should be. All right, there's another condition that's called myopia or nearsighted, and that's because the eyeball is way too long compared to the curvature of the lens and the cornea working together. And the lens and cornea bend the light back so that they focus in front of the retina. Right? And so we call that nearsightedness. You can see things close up but not far away. The light is being bent too much. Right? And the reason why that works for something up close is because light rays coming from objects that are close to you are diverging very rapidly. They're at a large angle. So you can see things close up, but not far away. All right. So in this particular case, the retina is way behind the focusing point, so things look blurry. The kind of lens that corrects for that, right, is a concave lens that we see right here. And a concave lens, not illustrated very well, will bend the light so that they start to angle away from each other so that when it goes through the cornea and lens, they focus exactly right on the retina. So that's a correction for myopia. The opposite condition, if somebody's eyeball is too short, right, that's what we call hyperopia or farsightedness. In this particular case, the light is not being bent enough by the cornea and the lens, and so they converge at a point behind the retina, so what you see is a blurry object. To correct for this, we just put a lens in front of the eye, a convex lens, right, which then starts to bend, and actually it's shown nicely here, it starts to bend the light rays together before it reaches the eye so that, right, they don't converge after the retina, they converge right on the retina right here. All right, so that's a nice convex lens that will do that. And that's what we call farsightedness. Okay, the last condition is astigmatism, where the curvature of a person's lens or the curvature of somebody's cornea right here is asymmetrical. It's not the same curvature on the superior compared to the inferior part, or compared to the medial and lateral part of the lens or cornea, so that light rays are being bent by different degrees depending on what part of the lens or cornea that it strikes. So a purely concave or convex lens won't help in the circumstance. It has to be an aspherical lens that has that asymmetry built into it. So we call that an uneven lens, but it's an aspherical lens. It doesn't have the nice spherical symmetry built into it. That can correct for astigmatism. And I think in lab you did all of these different exercises right here to see, to actually visualize your acuity. So for instance, if somebody has astigmatism and we look at a chart that's absolutely flat on the wall, so that chart, no matter where you look at the chart, it's a certain distance from your eye no matter where you look. If somebody has an astigmatism, one part of the chart will be out of focus, but another part will be in focus. So you can't focus within a plane because of that aspherical symmetry is disturbed. Okay, so let's start talking about the photoreceptor part of the eye. All right, so don't forget, three main layers of the eye. The most superficial is the sclera. It's a really tough connective tissue. All right, the next deepest layer is the choroid, and the choroid is loaded with blood vessels. And then we have the retina, which is the deepest layer. And the retina has an epithelium, and then it has a bunch of neuronal tissue, has a bunch of neurons, and then it has some specialized receptor cells. And these receptor cells have different shapes. Sometimes they're rods, sometimes they're cones, based on their shape. Rod cells, right, will be more like columns. They're very large. Right, the cone cells are going to be a lot smaller. That's illustrated not so perfectly on this diagram because it looks like the cone cells here are bigger than the rods, but that's not really the case. The cone cells are shorter and thinner as well, so that they're a lot smaller. All right, so here are the photoreceptor cells. You've got two basic kinds, rods and cones. And these rods and cone cells are located in different parts of the retina. But let's talk about what their function is first. The cone cell. Right here. Since it's a smaller cell, it's going to sample light from a smaller area that's entering the eye. And so it gives you very nice high-resolution images. It gives you very precise detail. But since they're small, they need a lot of light to operate. So that's the trade-off right there. It gives you very good vision, but you need bright light. The other thing that a cone cell is that there's different kinds of cone cells that can allow you to see different colors. So cone cells give you very high resolution vision and color vision. The downside is it needs bright light in order to work. Cone cells we have in our central vision that we use all the time, or most people use all the time for looking at things, right? Very close to the fovea centralis. I don't have pictures of these things, but hopefully you've reviewed some of these things in lab or you remember them from anatomy. Right, as you move away from the fovea centralis through the macula lutea to the peripheral vision, then cone cells gradually give away to rod cells. Rod cells are bigger. And since they're bigger, it takes less light to stimulate them. All right, so they're very sensitive to light. They work in dim light, but they don't give you color vision. So you can only see in shades of gray or black and white. And they don't give you fine detail. So you lose resolution because of that. So that's the trade-off. All right, so cone cells in your central vision for color and very high resolution. The downside, the trade-off is you need bright light. Cone cell, the rod cells over here, right, you find in your peripheral vision, they give you grayscale images that are very coarse resolution, but they operate really nicely in dim light. So maybe over the weekend or spring break, you can walk outside and look at some stars. And how are stars? Are they really bright or are they kind of dim? Stars, like far away, billions of miles away, trillions of miles away. They're kind of dim objects, all right? They're kind of dim. So when you look, if you look at a star and place it in your central vision, it should decrease in amplitude or intensity. And then move your focus of vision to the side of the star, and it should appear brighter as a result of that. All right, so look in your peripheral vision for a star that you can just barely see with your peripheral vision, and then look right at it with your central vision, and guess what will happen to it? It will disappear. You can't see it. So dim stars you can only see with rod cells that are in your peripheral vision. Dim stars you can't see with cone cells, which are in your central vision. So try that little trick over the weekend. Okay, the other thing that you notice right here is, look at all these different layers within the neural part of the retina. And so we have fibers of the optic nerve, and then here are the cell bodies. We call these the ganglion cells that then send axons into the optic nerve. All right, there's another layer right here of amacrine cells. Then we have a layer of bipolar cells. And remember, bipolar cells are the kinds of neurons that we find only in special senses, for instance, like vision. And then we have some horizontal cells. And then finally, the receptor cells. So light actually has to pass through all of these different layers within the retina before landing on the photoreceptor cells, which is kind of strange, right? So this is the sclera. Here's the deep part of the eye. And then light has to pass through all of these different layers. The amacrine cells and horizontal cells right here are important for signal processing, information that takes place in the retina before it even enters your brain. All right, so it adjusts contrast and colors and intensity. And we're not going to get into all the details of amacrine and horizontal cells, but they process and adjust the action potentials that are generated in ganglion cells. Okay, so what cells receive information from rods and cones? Right, we're going to look at bipolar cells. The horizontal cells adjust the activity of rods and cone cells, but we're not so interested in that. But we're interested in bipolar cells because they connect the photoreceptors to the ganglion cells. Right, so we're really interested in these bipolar cells. Let's look at, here's a pretty good diagram of a cone and rod cell. Now you can see how small a cone cell is compared to a rod cell. That's nicely depicted. And these cells have a couple different areas. Here we see the cytoplasm with mitochondria. Rods and cone cells need a lot of ATP. They're very active, so there's a lot of mitochondria in them. And here's the nucleus. This part of the cell that even has a little segment that looks like an axon and a synaptic ending right here. This is what we call the inner segment of a receptor cell. And the outer segment has layers and layers and layers of membranes that we call discs. And that's what we call the outer segment of both a rod and cone cell. Here's a nice electron micrograph of cone cells and rod cells next to each other. Okay, and these discs are being added from the inner segment, and then they migrate, okay, into the outer segment, and then they drop off the end of the cell, and it is the epithelial cells that then absorb that material that is being sloughed off of the receptor cells and recycles it back into the body. Okay, what else happens? The pigmented epithelium also absorb light, so that after it passes through the receptor cells, that light doesn't bounce around inside the eye, because if it did, then you would see flashes in your vision. Right? It also suppresses an immune response from your body to destroy these cells if that were ever to happen. Okay, I'm sure that does happen in some people. And when these rods and cone cells are destroyed, what happens to a person's vision when that happens? Well, then they lose that vision. Okay. Okay, and all of these cells get nutrients from blood vessels that are in the choroid. Now, there is a kind of condition where these blood vessels are tricked to grow up into the retina, up past through the pigmented epithelium, right? And it pushes these rods and cone cells away. So if you have a blood vessel that starts to grow into the retina, what happens to your vision in that area? You lose vision in that area as well. Okay, and we call that retinopathy of prematurity. Okay, for instance, years ago when a person was born prematurely, they were put in an incubator, which had high oxygen concentration. And today's incubators, there's still high oxygen concentration, but years ago, it was way too high. So oxygen would diffuse through the cornea, through the lens, right? So through the aqueous humor, through the vitreous humor, and high oxygen concentration in the retina right here would cause the stimulation and growth, or what we call angiogenesis, of blood vessels from the cornea into the retina. And then unfortunately those premature babies then were born with severe vision deficits or even blind as a result of that. So now, okay, when somebody is premature, that oxygen concentration in the incubator is adjusted depending on what kind of pulmonary function deficit the infant has, right, to maintain good blood supply in their blood without stimulating that angiogenesis of blood vessels into the retina. Right, so that just demonstrates what good clinical judgment, which is what clinical practice is all about, which is what you guys are going to get into. And you're learning some basics. All right, so where do we find blood vessels? In the choroid layer, not up in the retina. Okay, so how is it that those rods and cone cells can transduce light energy into action potentials? Let's see in how that is. Well, in order for you to perceive a sense, what do you need? What's the first thing? Well, you need a stimulus, okay, and that stimulus is light. What's the second thing you need? A receptor, something that is sensitive to that particular stimulus. And this is where it starts, with two molecules. So these two molecules are what we call retinol, which is a really long hydrocarbon. It's got a cyclic ring on one end, but it's a really long hydrocarbon. And then there's an opsin molecule, and these two things fit together with the right kind of shape because of the arrangement of these single bonds and double bonds between carbons. So retinol, or the cis form of retinol, can fit right inside this protein opsin. And this combination has the right energy so that it can absorb light in rod cells. And when light is absorbed, that causes a conformation change, a little rotation on the backbone of this retinol, and now it becomes all trans-retinol. And so instead of having a little hook or curve in the retinol molecule that allows it to fit into, you could think of this as like an active site on the opsin molecule, it changes shape, it can't fit into the active site, so it dissociates from opsin when that happens. It like kind of pops right out of it. This is what we call a bleaching reaction. And the thing that causes this bleaching reaction is light, because light has the sufficient kind of energy to change these conformations in retinol. And when retinol changes shape, it changes permeability to ion channels within the membranes of those discs that we were looking at, and that changes the membrane potential of the rod and cone cells. All right, so we're going to have to take a look at that in some detail. So those ganglion cells and amacrine cells produce action potentials, right? And every action potential, remember, is exactly the same. The rods and cones, bipolars, and the horizontal cells all produce graded potentials, right? And as a matter of fact, you might want to think of rods and cones producing generator potentials, right? Or receptor potentials, which is just a special kind of a graded potential. All right, so visual transduction is the inverse of other sensory systems. So you have to probably look at this a couple of different times. So usually when a receptor is stimulated, that's going to cause depolarization, right? In the rod cells, the opposite is happening. These cells are normally depolarized, and when stimulus is present, they become hyperpolarized. So in the dark, photoreceptors release an inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes those bipolar cells. Where are we at? Okay, so in the dark, these cells right here will inhibit the bipolar cells. And when there is stimulus, right, when there is light, light inhibits the photoreceptor cells from releasing that inhibitory neurotransmitter. And when that inhibition is released, then the bipolar cells become stimulated as a result. All right, so that's a little word slide for you, but in order to understand that, you really have to understand the next couple diagrams that we're going to talk about. All right, so rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. What does that mean? In the dark, what happens to cells? the rods and cone cells if the sodium channels are open. What does an open sodium channel produce? Depolarization, which is excitatory, right? So rods and cones are excited in the dark, right? And so in the dark, the sodium that's entering the cell, we call that a dark current because it's an electrical current because sodium has a charge on it, all right? But when the stimulus is present, once there's a light turned on, light then closes these sodium channels and it hyperpolarizes the rods and cone cells. All right, so let's take a look, step-by-step process of what's happening. There is a chemical compound called cyclic GMP, and cyclic GMP is a lot like cyclic AMP. Where does cyclic AMP come from? Can anybody remember? And maybe the name of the enzyme that produces it. Adenylate cyclase. We found that in the membrane, plasma membrane. When it becomes activated, it can grab an ATP, a regular old ATP, and convert it into cyclic AMP by chopping off two phosphate groups. So it's a special cyclic form of AMP. Well, we have GTP in our bodies, guanosine triphosphate, and it can be converted into cyclic GMP, just like cyclic AMP, by guanylate cyclase enzyme, which is normally active in these rod cells. So it's always producing cyclic GMP. When cyclic GMP is high, it can bind to this sodium channel right here, causing a conformation change to keep the sodium channel open. And so what happens to sodium then? Because sodium is high outside the cell, low inside, sodium will enter the cell because there's plenty of cyclic GMP. And this happens in the dark, when there is no stimulus, right? There's high levels of cyclic GMP, and that causes the cell to depolarize constantly in the dark. All right, now here are the discs that contain rhodopsin. Here's that cis retinol, right? And it doesn't have a stimulus, but when light is applied, okay, it gets changed into transretinol, and that activates a G protein. And the alpha unit of a G protein is released from the membrane of a disc, and it can float around in the cytosol and can bump into an enzyme, changing the activity of this enzyme. All right, so alpha unit has to be attached to it to become active. Otherwise, for instance, in the dark, it is inactive. And this is a phosphodiesterase. This relates to the cyclic GMP molecule. So guanylate cyclase will make cyclic GMP, and phosphodiesterase will destroy cyclic GMP. So phosphodiesterase will also inactivate cyclic AMP. It will convert it into just regular AMP. So there is a balance between phosphodiesterase and the guanylate cyclase enzyme. In the dark, the phosphodiesterase is inactive, but as soon as there is stimulus, right, the G protein activates the phosphodiesterase, which then converts cyclic GMP into just regular old linear GMP. And this form of the molecule can't bind to this sodium channel right here. It's a ligand-gated sodium channel. And when cyclic GMP comes off of this channel, it changes the conformation. It closes, so sodium can't enter the cell. And if sodium can't enter the cell, what happens to this cell right here? It hyperpolarizes. It becomes inhibited. And so that's why the rod cells become inhibited in the presence of light, in the presence of a stimulus, which is kind of strange compared to what you're used to. All right, well, why does that matter? Why do we want to know? Here is a real important exam figure. We have two circumstances in the dark and in the light condition. All right, so here is a nice rod cell. In the dark, remember, there's plenty of cyclic GMP because phosphodiesterase is inactive. Right, so sodium can enter the cell. That causes depolarization of the cell. Right, and when the cell is depolarized, it's going to release neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter is going to act on this bipolar cell, but the neurotransmitter that's being released is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. How can a neurotransmitter be inhibitory on the bipolar right here? What are some possible ways? Okay. There's a receptor, a ligand-gated receptor that can, maybe it's binding to a potassium channel that's opening up a potassium channel, which is causing hyperpolarization of the cell. Or maybe it's a chloride channel. So chloride enters the cell, which hyperpolarizes as bipolar, right? So that is inhibited. The bipolar cell is inhibited in what condition? In the dark, right? So in the dark, the bipolar cell is being inhibited even though the rod cell is being excited because of this dark current right here. So in the absence of stimulus, the bipolar cell is being inhibited, and therefore it does not release neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell. And since the bipolar cell is not releasing excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, is it sending action potentials to the brain? It's not sending action potentials to the brain in the dark, even though, okay, the rod cell is being excited because of this inhibitory neurotransmitter being released on the bipolar cell. All right, in the light, something interesting changes. That phosphodiesterase is activated because of the G protein, because rhodopsin is changed into opsin and into the retinol, right? That activates the phosphodiesterase, which then gets rid of cyclic GMP. So cyclic GMP, right, gets reduced. That closes the sodium channel. So now this cell here becomes hyperpolarized, which is what? Excited or inhibited? Inhibited. So if it's inhibited, it can't release neurotransmitter. And don't forget, that was an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So it's not releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter. So now this bipolar cell becomes depolarized. When it depolarizes, it releases excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion, which then sends action potentials to the brain as a result. So it's a really strange mechanism. You'll have to look at this slide a number of times, okay? And it all works because in the dark, the rod cell is excited. It works because the neurotransmitter that the rod cell releases is what? Inhibitory. All right, so the receptor cell is excited in the dark, it's inhibited in the light, and it works because the neurotransmitter that a rod cell releases is inhibitory on the bipolar cell right here. Yeah.
Is the bipolar cell like constantly releasing
it? Yeah, there are leak channels. There are leak channels. Yeah, so for instance, if we stop the release of this inhibitory neurotransmitter, this cell becomes depolarized. How would you think of depolarization? Sodium entering. So there are sodium channels that are always leaking sodium to the inside of the cell, which can be counteracted by this inhibitory neurotransmitter. But when you stop this inhibitory neurotransmitter, then those sodium channels that are normally open can kind of take over the balance of the activity of the cell right here, releasing neurotransmitter on this ganglion, which then sends action potentials to the brain. All right, so that's how that system works, which is what? Opposite of how you would normally think. Usually you think of, okay, stimulating a receptor cell, which might produce action potentials, but in this case, the receptor cell is stimulated in the absence of the stimulus, right? Because of these intermediate cells, these bipolar cells. What kind of cell is this bipolar cell right here? How many different kinds of tissues are there in the body? Can you remember how many different kinds of tissues you have? You have four. What do you got? You got muscle, you got connective epithelium, and nervous tissue. Of those four tissues, which one does this bipolar cell belong to? Nerve tissue, that's right. And that nervous tissue you can break down into two major categories. What are the two major categories of nerve cells? You've got neurons and support cells. Sometimes people say support cells are glial cells or microglia cells or some kind of glial cell. All right, so you got glial cells and neurons. What kind of cell is this bipolar cell right here? It's a neuron. Yeah, because you know neurons have how many different kinds of shapes?
Three.
The basic shapes, three, right? You've got, anybody remember the three basic kinds of shapes? You got multipolar, the pseudo-unipolar, and the bipolar. So this is where we find these bipolar cells in hearing and vision, which are special senses, right? So this is just a special kind of neuron that is used for vision, okay? And even this ganglion cell is kind of special as well, Okay, because most sensory neurons are pseudo-unipolar that have the nerve cell body and the dorsal root ganglion, right, as it enters the central nervous system. All right, so that's it for sensory system. How many senses are in the ear?
Three.
Two kinds of equilibrium, you should know what they are. All right, static and kinetic, or linear acceleration and angular acceleration, which is spinning. Okay, you should know the different organs. What about the receptor cells for kinetic, static, and hearing? What are the three kinds of receptor cells? They're all the same, that's right. They're all the same because it's not the receptor cell that gives you the perception, it's what? How about different action potentials going to the brain? No, because action potentials are all the same. What allows you to perceive different senses? Exactly what area of the cerebral cortex they go to, right? And what major part of the brain directs action potentials to the proper area of the cerebral cortex for your perception? That's the thalamus. Yeah, that's the relay station. Okay, so that's good enough until next time. Sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Please bring it down.